It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Giant on the beach!
Giant! No!
Bring derricks, a rig, bring pulleys, a jig, bring whatchamacallits, little and big, a thingamathud, a thingamajig, and all kinds of things and stuff like that there. Follow me!
Gulliver's Travels. Favorite story of men, women, and children in every nation of the world. Gulliver, the immortal character whose fabulous adventures in the land of the Lilliputians made him a classic of literature. Gulliver's Travels now comes to the screen. 1 solid hour and 20 minutes crammed full of laughter and gay music. Max Fleischer's first feature-length cartoon in gorgeous three-dimensional Technicolor with a host of new characters who soon will be old friends. Gabby, the town crier.
You can't do this to me. I got a wife and kids, millions of kids.
Sneak, Snoop, and Snitch, the three spies. King Little of Lilliput. King Bombo of Blefuscu. Twinkletoes, the cuckoo carrier pigeon. Princess Glory and Prince David. Thousands of hilarious, lovable Lilliputians. And gigantic Gulliver himself. You'll see them all in the picture that will delight millions to whom Gulliver and his Lilliputian friends have long been favorites.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, I am joined by Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
And it is kind of a pleasure to have you here. And we have the pleasure, and I, you know, now I can put pleasure in air quotes, of having Scott Gardner with us once again.
Hello!
Hello.
Thank you for having me again.
So now, those of you who are devotees of the show, and I don't know if there's anybody who fits that particular definition, but if you are, you would recall that not too long ago, the three of us talked extensively about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in what is to be the beginning of a retrospective of Disney animated features. But right off the bat, after the first movie, we decided to take a left turn and take a look at Gulliver's Travels, which is not a Disney movie, but it was Fleischer Studios' movie, and it was the competition for Disney at the time. So we thought it might be a good idea to take a look at that. And before we start digging into it, I wanted to hit on a couple of points. First of all, apparently the Fleischer brothers, Max and Dave, had been... They had a very different situation from Walt. in that they hedged their bets financially. And the interesting thing is, Walt gambled, and he ended up with Disney Studios, which now owns the world. And the Fleischer Studios, or the Fleischer Brothers, hedged their bet, and they ended up, as best as I can tell, going bankrupt. Because they ended up having Paramount Pictures bankroll them. And then that became a big thing, and they were asking Paramount to bankroll this particular movie starting in 1935, and Paramount didn't agree to it until after the success of Snow White.
And they even got a penalty for going over budget, which, I mean, it's a very different story than Waltz. Waltz was, yes, almost bankrupting the company, but it turned into, you know, a rags-to-riches story, whereas in this case, they got smacked.
Yeah, and apparently that, you know, there was not all was well in Fleischer land, because apparently at some point the two brothers had a severe falling out, and I think it was Max took over the running of the company, I believe. I could have it backwards, and that Dave was just kind of put into the position of just being kind of you take care of these little minor things, because I won't fire you, but I'm not going to let you do as much as you were doing in the past. We're not equals anymore. So there's that factor in this. And then there's also, you know, when I first threw this up on Wikipedia, now Gulliver's Travels is a 1700-something novel, 18th century. And apparently this is not the first film, because there was a 1902 silent film from France. There was a 1924 Austrian silent film, a 1935 Soviet film, and then this. So this is the fourth filming of this particular thing. Now, another factor that I want to just kind of throw in there, and this is just to give some background information, is Gulliver's Travels, which I've never read, is known to be a highly satirical work, not so much right. A children's fiction book, almost like, I guess, from my experience, like Animal Farm, where you could read it as a children's story, but it really has so many layers to it that there's really a lot of satire there if you're ready to see it. From everything I can understand, the Fleischer Studios version, first of all, took Gulliver's Travels and made it into Gulliver's Travel, because he only goes to one place in the movie, whereas in the book he goes to four different places. And they also, apparently, you know, they really toned down the satire and made it into just a children's fantasy story, more or less. So, you know, there's definitely things to be looked at in that respect. My familiarity with this is, as a kid, this was one of those staple movies that would be on, I'm not even sure which holiday, but around the holidays it would always be on. And we'd watch it every year. And I always thought it was great. And I'm not gonna hold off on it. I watched it this morning on YouTube, and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. So it hasn't really lost much of its luster. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what's happened since then. But first, I'd rather get into a little bit to see what your respective familiarity is with it.
I had never seen this before. Yesterday was the first time that I've ever viewed this, which, and we were talking about this a little bit before we recorded. I mean, if I did see it, it was as when I was a little kid, and I don't remember it, which is very odd for me with an animated feature to not at least have some recollection of it. So this is one, and watching the whole thing through, I don't remember any of it. There isn't like a scene where I'm like, oh, I remember this, or I remember those characters. Which, it's just very, I'm an animation fan. It's very odd for me to have missed something like this, especially with it being, I mean, it's a landmark in history in the fact that it was the second animated film of all time, and certainly the first one out of the Fleischer Studios. I'm surprised I've never seen this before, but this really was my first viewing.
Yeah, for me, it would have been, I was looking at the Wikipedia entry here, and you know, it was kind of dismaying for me as a fan of animation, primarily Disney, but I mean, I do consider myself an overall animation fan, to discover just how little I really knew about not only this movie, but just the Fleischer Studios in general. I mean, I am a huge fan of their Superman, you know, the 17 Superman shorts that they did. But beyond that, I didn't know a lot about them. So basically, you know, looking at the Wikipedia entry really kind of lit a fire for me. It's like, I need to know more about them. So I actually did acquire copies of all three of the books that they have listed under their further reading section on the Wikipedia for this movie. So I didn't get a chance to read any of them, but I'm looking forward to that at some point, because I would like to know more about, you know, their whole history and everything. As far as my history with it, I noticed in the Wikipedia article under the release section, it talks about when the Fleischer Film Library was sold to TV in 1955. It said Gulliver's Travels was included and became a local television station holiday film during the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. That's when I remember seeing it. I don't know about Christmas, but I definitely remember this being a Thanksgiving staple, probably on like WPIX or something like that. That's my memory of it anyway. But I also remember it being one of those things that was on, but I wasn't necessarily like sitting glued to it. So there were sections of the movie that were kind of solid in my mind, but it wasn't until sitting down for this rewatch that I kind of got the big picture, because I can't remember the last time I watched this. I was thinking it might have been when we covered a... Paul, help me out. What was that called? Marvel Classics?
Yes, we did do a Marvel Classics, and we also did a what felt like a softcore porn version of Gulliver's Travels.
It was a pornographic comic, but it was a foreign adaptation of Gulliver's Travels, but Gulliver is a female in that, and you know, use your own imagination. But I was thinking that I had watched it for some reason for that, but now I'm thinking maybe I didn't, because I remember you putting audio from this movie into either the beginning or the end of that episode, and I think that's what tricked my brain into thinking, oh, I recently watched this. But I don't think I actually did. I think this is my first rewatch in a long, long time. And so I had some mixed reactions to it. You know, there were definitely parts I remembered. There was a lot of it I didn't remember. It's an interesting film, but yeah, the big thing is just that, you know, historically speaking, I don't know necessarily important's the right word, but it's interesting where its place in history as the second animated film of all time, you know, full length animated feature. And I meant to conduct an experiment on that, and I totally forgot to ever do it. But I was going to poll friends and coworkers when we decided to do this and see how many of my Disney friends and coworkers could actually name the second animated feature. Because, I mean, I'm sure most of them know it's Snow White is the first. They should, as cast members. But I wonder if how many of them actually know what the second one is. And I'd be interested to know that. I think if you ask the average man in the street, they wouldn't know. And I think if you ask the average man in the street to name you something of Fleischer Studios, you might get 1 in 10 that know Superman or Popeye.
I think you're much more likely to get Popeye than even Superman, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know, among comic fans, the Superman animated shorts are huge, but among the general populace, it's not that they've been airing regularly throughout people's lives. I'll say I was until home video, I don't think I ever saw the Superman animated Fleischer cartoons. And this I knew from when I was a kid, and Popeye I knew from when I was a kid. So those would have been my Fleischer Studios memories. Yeah. Interestingly, just as a side note, they wanted to make this movie originally with Popeye in the role of Gulliver.
Right.
So that, yeah. That's an interesting little side thing, but I believe the studio said no. And just jumping into the movie a little bit, one of the things that I find interesting is that they separated Gulliver from the Lilliputians, not only because the Lilliputians have a much more cartoony look to them, but apparently Gulliver was rotoscoped. So, yes. So you know, he really was made to look like a man. And it's an interesting thing because, I never read the story. But from what I understand of the story and from what I understand that the way it was done, you know, Gulliver went all to these different worlds and he was your point of view character in each of the stories in that short story. Whereas in this movie, if I had to pull a point of view character, it would be Gabby.
Yeah.
You know, he's the one, and he's really the only one who has a significant personality or story arc to speak of at all. Everybody else is very two-dimensional, and it's okay because that's the kind of story we're getting. I mean, we have a 75-minute or somewhere around there, 76-minute movie here, and I don't think Gulliver speaks for the first 45 minutes of the movie. I don't think he's awake for the first 45 minutes of the movie.
That was kind of one of my issues with the movie is that it takes a long time to get moving because my memory of the movie versus the actual movie was very different because I thought it was pretty much there's the shipwreck, he wakes up on shore, they tie him up, he wakes up and there's a whole everybody panics, the giant. And like
you're saying, on the beach.
45 minutes into a movie that's not even an hour and a half. So it's like, yikes, you just burned up a lot of your movie before you really got to the meat.
Well, you know? It's before you get to the title character, but the title character is not the star of the movie.
No, yeah.
It's an insane sequence of events, though, and it sounds like I'm saying I don't like it, but it's not the case. But I was just loving the insanity of the fact that we've got this giant who has collapsed on the beach, and they're afraid of this giant. Let's bring him home.
There's a little bit of King Kong there.
and let's spend a lot of time bringing him home.
But you know what? That's one of the things about this is, and I guess this is, you know, it's early enough in the movie-making time that they're still not that far removed from silent movies. So yeah, there's a lot of the animation here that has to do with, and I just thought it was fascinating to watch it as an adult. I don't know how enraptured I was with it as a kid, but when they're tying him up and they show like they're tunneling underneath him to bring the ropes through, and then they use a pulley to pull his hand over to put coming down so that they could tie a knot. There's just so many little things that they did and such attention to the visual detail that I just thought it was great as far as that goes. And I didn't mind the fact that Gulliver isn't awake through most of it because he's dull. My, you know, it's like, such, yeah. You know, Gabby's the fun character.
I think I may have been thinking of another version of this movie because I was under the impression that they secured him to the beach. And then when he wakes, I have a visual in my mind of him waking up and sitting up and like pulling all the ropes and the straps and, you know, everything up. And that wasn't exactly the case in this.
I think that may be the Popeye version, because they did do a Popeye version at some point.
Right.
And there was also, I have a vague memory of like a Casper the Friendly Ghost cartoon that had a similar thing in it. It's very vague, that memory. But I remember him being tied up and having to...
I think there's a live-action one from like the 50s or 60s.
Well, there's the Three Worlds of Gulliver from 1960, and I know I saw that as a kid. Yeah. And that's interesting because it's the Three Worlds, not the Four Worlds. But anyway, you know, that has – I remember that has the Lilliputians. Then he goes to another one where everybody's giant and he's small, and I don't even remember what the third world is. I think the third world is home. I don't think there was a third island that he went to. So it's really just two stops.
In the original story, there's the floating, like the city in the clouds with like the weird intellectuals or whatever they were. And then there was like the talking horse land.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very weird story. Well, you mentioned Gabby and... He's a weird character because I kind of like him and dislike him at the same time. Part of my problem with him, and this goes for most of the characters in the movies, I just find him a little ill-defined because he starts out as the, what do they call it, the Night Crier. And then he shifts into basically he's in charge of everything, the whole operation of...
I took that as he's in charge because he's the one who found it.
Okay, I guess I can see that.
And the king that he's working for, the king of Lilliput, is not exactly the, you know, the toughest guy in the world.
Right.
And just as a, as an aside there, his voice actor, Jack Mercer, was the voice of Popeye.
Popeye, yeah.
And the voice of Gabby is like the voice of a lot of cartoons, including Goofy and Pluto.
Yeah, he's Pinto Colvig. Yeah, he was Goofy. He was Pluto. He was the Grasshopper and the Grasshopper and the Ants, one of the greatest silly symphonies that that Disney did. Yeah, and so the fact that they sped up his voice and gave him like chipmunk voice was a little bit irritating because it's like he is a voice actor. He can do a wide range of voices, so why not let... Oh, and also he was Grumpy in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the movie that this is competing with, or, you know, riding the coattails of, however you want to look at it. So, you know, he can do all these different voices, so why not let him do a voice instead of giving him this weird... To me, he sounded like sped up Popeye. And I thought that was... It was weird and kind of distracting. I guess they were going for, you know, he's a tiny person, so mm-hmm. he's supposed to have, like, a high, squeaky voice, I guess?
That's what I took from it. But, you know, I got to say, as a kid, I loved Gabby, and as an adult, I still found him to be charming. I had no issue whatsoever. He didn't bother me in the slightest. One of the things I found interesting in this was there really is no villain. You know, it's two kings who are kind of the victim of their own hubris and egos that they need their songs to be the one that's going, and they're willing to go to war over it, so they're kind of the villains, but neither one is presented as being worse than the other, really. You're rooting for King Little kind of because you stayed with him, but they're both kind of dopey.
King Bombo, if it was one of the two that I'm going to be a little bit harsher on, it was King Bombo. Because I think King Little was more the meek one of the two. Right. I don't know that he was ready to go to war. I mean, he was definitely pushing his song, which was, you know, the whole foil of this whole thing. But King Bombo was like, we're done. We're going to war. I mean, it's like everything was war. We're ready to go to war. King Little didn't do anything to squelch that either. I'm not like sitting there and saying, no, he's absolved from this whole thing. But Bombo, out of the two, I thought I would get invested in this.
He's closer to a villain. I'll give you that. But I don't think anybody's the villain.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing with you. But I'm saying if there's one out of the two that I'm like, who would you scold more? It'd be Bombo.
Right. Right.
And Bombo's the one who sends the spies over. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, you can kind of give a little bit of a weight to that, but I'm not so sure that Little wouldn't do the same thing in the reverse situation.
He'd be too afraid to.
And you see, I think one of the things that they do to emphasize there ain't no good guys, there ain't no bad guys, there's just the two of them and they disagree. When Gulliver squelches the combat at the end and he pulls all the ships together, when some of Bombo's men fall into the water, he scoops them out and puts them back on the deck. He's not letting right. anybody become the casualty of this war.
You mentioned attention to detail, and that was an example because it wasn't just one scoop. It was they fell out in like different configurations. And I like that in order to pull them back in, he had to do like multiple scoops. Like he had to do one scoop for the one batch and then that other one that fell out afterwards. There was tiny things like that that I really liked. Actually, like in him, the whole scooping sequence, you mentioned the rotoscope before. Those were some sequences where that kind of shined. It was, if you're kind of comparing this to Snow White and the Disney Studio, what they were doing then, and we talked about this at length in our episode, so I'm not going to go crazy with this, but they were crafting new kinds of cameras. They were doing all kinds of crazy stuff. For this one, I will say the rotoscope use was something where I'm like, okay, now I'm starting to see some, like, wow, Fleischer's kind of like trying to do some cool stuff. And it gave it a different sort of flair. And that part of it I really did appreciate because, you know, like when he was grabbing the ships, there was something at that point because we hadn't seen Gulliver because he'd been sleeping for most of the film. You know, right. When we finally got to see him in action like that, it really had a captivating visual at that point. And it was actually impressive to see him like grab all of those anchors and pull them because he's this big guy. So he's doing things that like people wouldn't normally think to do. He's kind of like, but he became like dad. And I actually really liked it. I was like sitting here, I'm like, all right, he's scolding the children. And it was kind of fun to watch because like, okay, they're throwing, and really the only thing that could hurt him was his own doggone weapon. So I was really enjoying seeing him interacting with these smaller objects in this world, but these ships had a particularly like a heft to them because of the fact that they were carrying multiple of the people. So, you know, there was something of a little bit of a weight to them, and Gulliver had to actually, you know, kind of have a little backbone to him and kind of yank everything. I thought it was cool. I really liked that sequence quite a bit.
And I think, like you said, I think you can credit the rotoscope for that because they probably had a real guy in some water pulling something. So you had the right musculature moving, the right leaning, you know, made it look very, very real and yet still have its cartoony feel to it. And again, you know, the fact that he was rotoscoped and nobody else was created a separation because they're not supposed to be the same species. You know, they're on the same planet, but they're different beings.
I think the lovers were the Princess Glory, and I missed the prince's name. I didn't catch his name. What was it?
David.
I believe much of their stuff was rotoscoped as well, particularly the prince. And that was a bit distracting to me because I didn't understand why I feel like Gulliver should have had his unique look. He should have been the only one that looked the way he looked and have all the Lilliputians look like Gabby and the kings and everybody else looks. But by mixing that look and having the lovers have Gulliver's look, it was kind of odd and distracting to me, especially when you have scenes with, like, say, with Bombo and his son. I mean, he's supposed to be his biological son, yet they're two completely different styles of animation, and that's a little weird and distracting to me. I don't know. What did you guys think of that?
Bombo should be asking for a DNA test. I don't know who Mrs. Bombo was seeing, but it seems like there may be somebody else there. Yeah, you know what? I didn't really focus in on that when I was watching it, but now that you say it, I could see where that could be distracting. Their characters were ciphers to just do what, you know, just to bring the story along. So I didn't focus as much on their animation as I did the characters that really, I mean, you don't focus on David, I don't think, until he's trying to save Gulliver at the end.
Right.
Before that, he's just there singing his, singing his song and hugging Princess Glory. And there's really not a heck of a lot more to him than that.
Right.
I think they were going for them being like a beacon at the end, you know, of like just a better life, you know, because, you know, the two of them kind of combined together at the end when they combine the two songs. They do like the first mashup, which I thought was fascinating. I'm like sitting here like we talk about mashups now like this is this like really, you know, revolutionary thing. I'm like, I don't know. They were doing this in 1939 in Gulliver.
You know,
they solved the world's ills.
two thoughts about that. The first one is I had a memory of the conflict being different, and I think it's from the movie Three Worlds of Gulliver, and I think it's from the actual story that it was taken. In that, they don't have the conflict over the songs. They have it over which side of a hard-boiled egg or a soft-boiled egg you crack open first, the wide end or the thin end. And I think that's actually from the from the novel.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a Jonathan Swift thing, yeah.
But, you know, to me, that's almost like your, you know, Frank Gorshin on Star Trek. You know, he's black on the right side and none on the left. You know, such a silly conflict, but that's the satire. And I think, you know, again, I think this movie didn't really want to focus as much on the satire. I think they made a slight, very slight mistake in that they let you in on the secret, on the resolution beforehand. Because he says something about, well, why can't you sing them together, like 15 minutes before he actually has them sing it together. So it's like he already gave it away. And then they do the same thing when you think David got killed, and then you see the birds go over and they look at him and they're all sad, and then all of a sudden they're happy and you know, okay, he's alive. And I think it would have been better if the reveal of him being alive was when Gulliver actually opened his hand and showed him. I think you could have kept the audience in suspense a little bit longer. They're not major mistakes, but I do think it would have been better if they held back a little of that information.
It did make Gulliver a little cocky. You know, the only argument that I would make is kind of to your point about it a little bit. You know, did they maybe make a little bit of a mistake there? They're skirting a little bit of a line with him where, you know, he's kind of telling them what to do, to how to solve their problems way beforehand. He kind of hides the fact that this guy's still, which is a little bit cruel, the fact that this guy's still alive and the birds are revealing it. I did like the little wink to the birds.
But I thought that was purposeful, though. He held back on them because he wanted them to think, wow, we screwed up and now David's dead because of it. You know, right. He didn't want to let them know right away that he was okay because he wanted them to feel the weight of their misdeeds. So I'm kind of okay with that. Go ahead.
I'm not disputing it. I just think he was skirting a line where if they kept going, there was borderline where this guy started to look a little cocky. Well, I actually like him. So I'm not saying that they went. I'm not saying they went that far, but they were getting to an edge with him.
I remember, you know, we do a Hitchcock retrospective as well, and I remember one of the things I remember Hitchcock saying, and I've said it several times, is that there's the difference between suspense and surprise. And, you know, when you do a jump scare, that's a surprise. Suspense, you know, the example he gave was there's a bomb in a room. And if there's two people sitting at a table and then the bomb goes off, that's a surprise and it's a jump scare and it's shocking. But then it's over. He said it's much more suspenseful to show the two people in a room and then show the bomb with the clock ticking and that the people are unaware of it and time is running out and you're building up the suspense. So now, in this instance, trying to put Fleischer Studios to Hitchcock, he shows the audience that they're alive, that David's alive. So the audience is the only one who knows because you see the bird's reaction. But I don't see how removing that doubt helps the audience. I think the audience, by keeping it going a little longer, the audience is going to be sad that this really two-dimensional character who now has broken out of that second dimension by showing his bravery and saving Gulliver, to think, you know, that this character is now dead and I'm going to be sad over it. Oh, look, he's still alive. Unless they're just afraid that small children are watching this and would be too upset. That's the only reason I can come up with for showing the reveal that he's still alive so quickly.
I mean, that makes sense.
Just in trying to have you ride along with Gulliver, I don't know. I mean, you know, as far as like, you know, we're wink wink with Gulliver on this scenario, I mean, I can't think of another reason why to do it. I'm with you. I the suspense, I think, would have been much more thrilling, you know, if they'd left it in. It was a choice that it didn't ruin the film for me, but I'm with you that like not having that happen would have been, I mean, it was a clever way to use the birds, and that was a cute little animation sequence, so I get what they were going for there, but I think they sacrificed the suspense for a cute little animation sequence.
Yeah, I think what I would have, maybe I'm just morbid, I don't know, but I think, you know, if I were directing this movie, I think what I would have done was I would not have given the reveal from the birds, and I would have cut to Glory at some point and show how she's devastated because she thinks he's dead, and then you have the reveal that he's alive and she goes running into his arms. I think that's the way I would have done it.
I like your version.
It might be slightly more grown up, so maybe that's, again, maybe that's why they didn't want to do it.
I think there's that, but I also think, you know, this movie, for one thing, the movie was a little rushed, you know, from my understanding, you know, because they really wanted to get it out there and ride that wave, you know, generated by Snow White. They, you know, they wanted a piece of that action. So there's that. But, you know, in watching this, you know, I wanted to watch it and I wanted to enjoy it for what it is. But I also was watching it more with an eye towards, you know, literally, you know, what we decided to watch it for, which was the comparison with Snow White. And so a lot of my look at this movie on this watch was, you know, looking at it from the perspective of what are the differences between, like, how Walt portrayed his characters, how Walt made decisions with different scenes, and he just he had this intuition of when things were working and when things were not working. That when I watch this movie, I can definitely see that the Fleischers did not have that same intuition, because there are scenes that are not working and they just keep going. And there's other scenes like the one that you just said where it could have worked, but they spoil it, you know, by spoiling the suspense. So they could have done something a little bit differently, because I think they wanted that to be the possible, like, audience cry moment that we get in Snow White when, you know, the dwarves are mourning Snow White. We think she's dead. She's, you know, she's in a glass coffin, and audiences wept at that movie. And I think that's what they were kind of going for in the David scene, and it just doesn't work because it's not let to breathe long enough, and there's not enough suspense. It happens, and then it's resolved within moments after, and so there's not enough time for you to feel like, oh my gosh, you know, and feel anything. And I agree with you. You know, they could have had some cutaways to Princess Glory and her being absolutely devastated, a little bit more of that. And I noticed that sort of thing through the whole picture. And this probably makes it sound like I was totally down on this movie. I'm not. It's just, it is a really wonderful illustration to me just how far ahead Disney was from everything else at the time. Because this one, while it is beautifully animated, the story's not quite there. The characters, I don't feel, are anywhere near fleshed out and three-dimensional and complete like the characters in Snow White. And then there is the animation style. For as beautiful as it is, it's pretty far behind Disney at this point, because the Lilliputians in this still look like that early Silly Symphonies era, at a time when Snow White has just shown that you can totally forget you're watching a cartoon and just get completely sucked in, because it's a motion picture. And I think that's the real difference between these two movies, is that Snow White, at the end of the day, may be an animated film, but it's a film. It is a movie that stands on its own, whereas this is really just an extended cartoon. And I think that's really the big difference.
I think I disagree with you to an extent, because I think this is pretty complete. I you know, we have no choice but to compare them. That was our goal in the first place. But while Snow White is superior to this in my mind, if I didn't have the hindsight of knowing what the two studios did and being able to put it all together, if you just showed me that one and then you showed me this one and said, oh, it's the same studio, I don't know that I would have questioned you. I think I would have said, okay, I like this one better, but they're both really good. I agree with you that Snow White is ahead of this. I just don't think it's as far behind Snow White as you do.
Okay.
I actually kind of agree a little bit with the Silly Symphonies comparison, though, in this one. And it's not knocking this film, because Silly Symphonies, when you look at them, are actually brilliant in their own right. They were an artistic experimentation. I think what's the difference between this and Snow White for me is, this is going to seem very strange to say, we take for granted now that Snow White is a by-the-numbers fairy tale. But when you rewatch that, how many times when you rewatch Snow White do you sit there and go, man, there's some sequences here that were a lot darker than I remember.
Right. There's
an edge to Snow White that I forget every time I watch it. And that's the unique, if we step away from it and for a couple years I don't watch Snow White and we talk about it, I'm not going to feel that way. I'm gonna feel like, oh, it's another fairy tale. Oh, sure, I'll watch Snow White. I remember liking that movie. But then when I watch it, I'll sit there and go, ooh, there's just an edge to it. There's something that they're doing in that that just feels a little different. This, it sounds like a knock to it. But I agree with you, Paul, in the sense that you're saying it's a complete story. It is. Because I feel like this is a by the number, at least what I consider a by the numbers fairy tale. It's safe. And I like it. It's fun. There's a humor value to it. It's more of a comedy. Strange to say that it's more of a comedy than Snow White, because Snow White definitely, like, got paid extra for gags. But Snow White's darker in its own, like, weird way than this because of some of the choices they make in this one.
I'm gonna argue with you a little on the darkness, because I think the stuff with the gun in this is very dark.
I was gonna say that too. Honestly, that's the only part of it that I feel is dark, but that is pretty dark. Well, that and at the beginning, that, you know, if you're not familiar with the story, it looks like a man is drowning at sea. That's pretty dark in its own way too. If you don't know where it's going.
Except we saw a girl poisoned in Snow White.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to give competing darkness. I'm just saying they both have their darkness in them.
I felt like we can all agree to disagree in various degrees on this one. I do feel, out of the two, I feel like Snow White just feels darker. It sounds, but that doesn't have to be a knock on this film. I'm just saying there's some, when I'm looking at this, I'm looking at one lane, I'm looking at that as another lane, and it's not even so much a which one is better than the other as far as that end goes. There's a different, I guess this one does feel tonally different to me.
It is tonally different, and that's okay. It's a different movie. I would I would be more down on it if it seemed like it was a copy of Snow White.
I agree.
What's funny to me, and we haven't gotten there yet, obviously, but it'll be interesting when we get to Pinocchio.
Which will be next on our list.
Right. See, I find this a closer comparison with Pinocchio than I actually find it a comparison with Snow White, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it might be. I think you might be onto something there, and when we get to Pinocchio, we'll see where we go with that. One of the thoughts I had about this is I wonder if the Fleischers thought this could be a franchise. You know, I mentioned it should be Gulliver's Travel instead of Gulliver's Travels. I wonder if they thought, well, we could do this one, and then we'll do a sequel where he goes to the land where everybody's bigger, and then we'll do a sequel where he goes to the place where horses talk, or whatever. And they did have spin-offs. Gabby had a series of cartoons.
Right.
The Three Spies had a series of cartoons, and the Carrier Pigeon had a series of cartoons. I can't say I've ever seen any of them, but I know that they exist.
Right. Is Lilliput the first world in the original story?
I think so, but again, I've never read it.
Right.
So, are there any other characters that you think stood out that are worth discussing? I mean, I did get a kick out of the Three Spies. I could see easily where you could do the spin-off cartoons. Again, never seen them, but I could see where they could lend themselves to that.
See, there were certain elements of this that, you know, clearly they borrowed some things from Snow White, you know, from Disney in this. Most obviously to me was the Hap Hap Happy Day song. Mm. You listen to that song, it's Whistle While You Work. It's a Hap Hap Happy Day, Whistle While You Work. It's the same song. It's just with different lyrics. And I was shocked. I'm like, oh my God, Walt didn't sue the pants off them for that? But I was kind of surprised that there were characters in this that remind me of Disney characters down the road. So you mentioned the spies. The spies and their interaction with the short spy that looked different than the other two reminds me an awful lot of characters that we're going to see in the next one, in Pinocchio. They remind me of Honest John and Kitty a lot. But we'll see that when we get there. Also, the Kings, in their initial interactions at the very beginning of the movie, when we first meet them, their camaraderie and the way that they're interacting with each other reminded me an awful lot of the Kings in Cinderella.
They also, the,
or the King, also, I should say. I think there's only one now that I think about it, but yeah, I'm sorry.
The spies also reminded me strangely, and you guys might disagree about this one, the Lonesome Ghosts from Disney.
Yeah.
Certain elements of that that they were reminiscent of that. I'm not saying they were a clone or anything like that,
right?
But certainly some of what the qualities that I remember from that certainly.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. That's a good call, yeah. Because, yeah, they were giving me a vibe I couldn't quite place, but yeah, that might be it. Exactly, yeah. That's a good call. The whole thing with the princess and the prince, the prince I feel was okay. He was a little too close to the prince in Snow White in some instances, but one of the things that I couldn't help but make a note on this, and I don't know, Paul's probably going to really disagree with me, is unfortunately with this one, I feel like there are several sequences in this movie that really drag. It doesn't have it has pacing problems that I feel like Snow White doesn't have, because, I mean, honestly, to me, now granted, I'm a huge fan, so maybe I'm not completely objective, but for me, there's only one part of Snow White that kind of drags a bit, and that's the fact that when the dwarves return to the cottage, from the point where they return to the cottage to through the end of the washing up scene, that just lasts way too long, in my opinion. And it's funny because that's even cut down from how much longer it was going to be. There was going to be a whole nother song in there, a whole nother animated sequence that Walt excised. But that part, to me, does drag a bit. It just runs a little bit too long. There were several in this movie that I felt kind of the same way. The big one was Princess Glory's song. Now, I realize they need to give you both songs to kind of establish the difference between the songs and how they eventually meld at the end. But her whole singing sequence, just, they're going so hard for a Snow White vibe that just doesn't work in that sequence at all. She doesn't have the same voice. She doesn't have a particularly good singing voice. The song's not really that great, and that sequence just goes way too long. I don't know. How do you feel?
The singing voices for David and Glory were both popular singers of the day. I don't know either of them, but they were apparently, you know, it didn't go out onto the street and just find somebody. These were apparently fairly well-known singers at that time. So I don't know about the voice. I'm not a huge fan of Snow White's voice, honestly.
Right.
So that didn't really bother me. I it's one of the things I take as a trope of the time, where they would shoehorn in certain musical things, to the point where you kind of felt sometimes like you don't really need this here. I can kind of agree with you and disagree. Like, I agree with you, like, that they could have gone a little quicker with the musical parts like that, because they did feel a little forced. But I do think that that's common for the time that this was made. There's a lot of movies, you know, that I love that have forced musical sequences in them. Some Marx Brothers movies, some Abbott and Costello movies. It just seems to be like what they did back then. So I kind of just like shrug my shoulders and wait for unless on the rare occasion, every once in a while, they're very entertaining. When they show Chico Marx playing the piano, I'm like glued to my screen watching that because the way he played the piano was so entertaining. But most of the time, I just kind of wait through the musical numbers.
The two Marx Brothers movies that are my favorite are Night at the Opera and Horse Feathers. What edges out Horse Feathers every time is the fact that it's just, it's better at the way that it handles the music of the time. It moves a lot quicker. And he gets to the comedy, and I think it's comedy perfection. That's just, it's his personal preference. But those are, by the way, two movies that are on the top of my list. I can watch over and over again endlessly. But the musical piece is to the point of some of that stuff being dated. I think that it always edges out Horse Feathers for me. In this case, it's funny comparing it to Snow White with this one when it comes to music. I felt like this one felt a little bit more dated for me, and it's unfair to the film, only because of the fact that I don't have the attachment to the music. I did not grow up watching this one, whereas Snow White, I did. So I give it extra credit because of the fact that these are songs that are comfort food for me in Snow White, that they aren't here. So I'm not knocking the film when I say that to anybody listening. I'm not like not deducting points because of it, but it's music at the time. And it was when those sequences came out of this, because I don't have the history with them. They didn't like destroy the film for me or anything. It was just kind of, it's music of the time. It's kind of like one of those things that they kind of did at the, but it definitely was something, the dated aspect of it, I noticed a bit more than I did in Snow White. Don't get me wrong. We were talking about Snow White having a little bit of a dated feel at times too. So it's not like we ignored that, but I admit that they got extra credit because of the comfort food act. For me, it was comfort food aspect of it.
Right.
And it's interesting that they got two Academy Award nominations, and one was for Best Music Original Score, and one was for Original Song, Faithful Forever. They both lost to Wizard of Oz, which I have to agree with. But they did get the nominations, so those songs were fairly well received at the time. And, right. You know, I mean, again, are they dated? Yeah, but they weren't bad. I mean, I'm okay with them. They didn't really feel to me. I mean, you know, you said I might disagree with you. I do, but only mildly. They didn't really add a lot to it as far as I was concerned, but they also didn't take away from it. So it's a very mild disagreement. So, what did you think of the score? Because except for the songs, I thought the score was not something you'd listen to in a vacuum. I don't think you'd listen to it on its own, but I thought it had the very cartoony, almost silent movie feel to it, that the music was meant to emphasize the motion that you're seeing on the screen.
Right.
You know, I think there was a lot of elements to this that had that feel to it, that, you know, it was almost a silent movie at parts.
Yes.
So, you know, but I thought
the tying up of Gulliver's sequence in particular, just to jump back to that just for a second, the amount of things that were going on there and the music that was accompanying that was fun. And without going, it's strange to say without going too far over the top, but it was fun because of the fact that it was these little people that were trying to climb over this giant and trying to somehow navigate it in a speedy fashion. It kept it, it had the slapstick aspects that you would expect from that. They managed to somehow keep that from going too far. It was fun. And the music was a big part of that whole sequence going down. I enjoyed that.
I hadn't really thought about it ever until I was watching it for this recording. But that whole sequence I found to be exceptionally entertaining to me, because of the things that they showed, like how they actually got him tied, like as I mentioned before, the tunnel that they drove, that they got underneath him so that they could bring the rope down through under him. It almost had like a Rube Goldberg feeling to me, like this whole machinery that they had going to get him.
But with the tunnel, though, doesn't that mean that he is then tethered to the ground? Because then they lift him up and put him onto the cart and take him into town. So how does that work exactly?
I got to think when they tunneled, he was the top of the tunnel and they just went underneath it. You know what I mean? I don't think they actually went 2 feet under him. I think they went directly under him.
Okay.
So this way they
don't. Yeah, I like that explanation because I wasn't thinking about it until Scott said it. I'm like, oh, he's pointing out an excellent point there. But I like your answer.
Yeah, and neither of us knows whether that's reality or not. So that's my mind, my head canon. So, one of the things I wanted to talk about before we start wrapping this up is. Because I really thought this was very entertaining, and I was very entertained by it as a kid. The interesting thing is, when I was a kid, you really couldn't see Snow White, and we talked about that last time, how Disney right. held back the movies. So this was, you know, more accessible, certainly. And then I believe it fell into the public domain, and there were a million versions of it out there to buy, you know, very cheaply. Why is it that I think this is not in the public consciousness anymore? I think this is totally faded from you know, perception to, like, I don't think you're going to find any 7-year-olds who grew up watching this movie. I think if, you know, whereas you're going to find them that they watched Snow White because, you know, that got released. And even when I was 7, I knew this because it was out there. But I think I had never seen it, I would have known Snow White too. And I think that's really, like, that's the explanation I came up with, and I'm interested in hearing from you guys. I think this is a public relations thing. I think Disney has managed to just keep its stuff in the public consciousness, and I think that whole, you know, oh, it's in the Disney vault, you can't see it thing has you know, fed the desire to have these things. And then, you know, you top that off with the fact that, you know, Disney did have a slowdown period, and I guess we're going to get to that as we do these. But then they had their resurgence, and, you know, they've always been in the public consciousness. So I think that's the reason, but it just doesn't make sense to me that this should have become a non-entity, which is really what it is at this point.
I think it's several factors. I think from the Disney angle, you really hit on something of, you know, the Disney vault. So, you know, Snow White, just looking strictly at Snow White, got multiple re-releases theatrically, basically one for every, you know, every generation, until it was eventually released on home video in the late 80s, early 90s. So there's that, you know, that they kept it fresh and kept it in the public conscious without having it completely and readily accessible. It was just enough to keep it alive type of thing. Plus, Snow White was a massive hit on the level of, like, Star Wars or the Avengers today. So there was tons of merchandise. I mean, there were dolls, there were records, there were comic books, there were, you know, all the things that you would expect of a major theatrical hit. Gulliver, to my knowledge, didn't have that. I struggled to find where it had been adapted into a comic book, and I could be wrong, but I don't think at its time that it ever was. The closest I found is that apparently it did eventually get adapted sometime in the 2000s of all things. I don't think it got multiple theatrical re-releases. You know, this thing on Wikipedia says that the library got sold in 1955 to television, and then it started airing on TV. So there's that, which, I don't know, on the flip side, though, you would think maybe that would keep it a little bit more, you know, like Wizard of Oz. You know, Wizard of Oz was a perennial thing, so I don't know. That is a little bit odd in that respect. The biggest thing for me, and Paul, I feel like you're going to completely disagree with this, is that it's fine for what it is. But it's very much two things. It's very much of its time. It's very much kind of almost mired in pretty much the era it's been produced in. But also because of deficiencies, I feel, in the overall story and the way the story is handled, it lacks timelessness. And that's one thing that both Snow White and The Wizard of Oz, which it was, you know, sort of competing with as well, that's one thing that those films, you know, if you had to name like one quality that, that links those two films, it is timelessness. I don't feel like Snow White or The Wizard of Oz, neither one of those movies feel anywhere near as old as they actually are. And to me, neither one really feels mired right in the time that it was made, because it sort of, they both sort of transcend that. Yes, there may be certain hairstyles or certain cultural references or something like that that kind of tie them to that era, but not rigidly. I think a lot of people that have grown up with watching those movies, or even kids discovering them today, don't realize just how quite old those movies are, because they have a quality that, that puts them above that. Whereas I don't feel like this movie does. I looked at this movie and immediately thought, you know, 30s era Silly Symphony films, because it's just, that's the animation style, that's the storytelling style. It hadn't made that next evolutionary leap yet that Disney had already done.
I think there's a couple other things that are a factor here as well, though. And I'm agreeing with everything you're saying. Adding on to that, though, when you take a look at the Fleischer Studios lifespan, I think that hurts it. You know, the fact that it did not have the longevity that Disney did. But also, I'm echoing some of the pieces you were saying. Brand marketing, as far as when you think of Betty Boop, when you think of Popeye, when you think of even their Superman cartoons. Yes, you think of the Fleischer Superman cartoons, but you think of these as isolated things. I didn't know that there was a Gulliver's Travels by the Fleischer Studio before we said, let's do Gulliver's Travels. I was aware of the Fleischer name because of the Superman cartoons. When we were doing this, I look back and I'm like, Popeye, I'll be honest, out of the whole batch, if you were to say to me, Sean, growing up from your life, what is the Fleischer property that stands out to you the most? Popeye. I saw Popeye every weekend. Popeye during the week. Popeye cartoons were popping up all over the place in different marathons and things like that. If you said, Sean, did you know that was a Fleischer property? I'm sure it popped up in front of the cartoons. I'm sure. I don't remember that. Right. That does not stand out for me. Disney does. And that's not a knock on Fleischer. It's an unfortunate piece because, quite frankly, Fleischer should be connected with all these properties. So I'm not knocking it by saying that. The other piece that I was going to say, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say this piece, Disney was crazy. And my point with saying that, I'm not knocking. I'm a huge Disney fan, by the way. So you can look behind me and you can't see this video podcast, but I'm a huge Disney fan, and I'm actually a big fan of Walt himself. I've read a lot of biographies with him. Where I say he was crazy, though, you need a certain amount of creative crazy to do what he did over and over again. Right. We talked about what he did with Snow White bankrupting the company. That was not a one-time thing.
No, this is Walt, he did it over and over again.
Walt's particular brand of crazy and genius kept on going throughout his career, throughout his life, in a way that Fleischer could not replicate in order to make the same stamp. Fleischer definitely made a mark as a studio, and if you take a look at the properties, they're woo. But it's really hard to compare the two companies and be able to give it just because of the time frame that they were in. But I think that's a piece that why does Gulliver get lost, which is really the question that Paul's asking. Some of that I don't think is due to quality. I think it's due to it's unfortunate circumstances. I think more than anything else, I think it's a victim of circumstances where it doesn't have the same longevity as the other company that we're comparing it to. And the machine that is Disney, like you mentioned earlier, the vault, being able to shove those things back in, bring them back out, remaster them, polish them up real nice. You haven't seen this in ages. Now you can see it a way that nobody's ever seen it.
Right.
That's something that they've been... When was Gulliver put out like that?
No, never. No, I honestly...
Well, wait. You can get it on Blu-ray remastered. And the only reason why I know this is... I bought it this morning because of the fact that, I mean, which I'm giving away a little bit here, but I bought it this morning because of the fact that I was doing a search. I'm like, has this thing ever been remastered? Because we've seen these copies of it. And I actually want to see it remastered because I've had the benefit of seeing Snow White remastered. I would love to see this remastered just to see what, when it's cleaned up, what it looks like.
You're back to Paul's original question of, you know, why hasn't this, you know, had the legs? That actually could heavily owe into it as well, is that I remember, you know, again, you know, I was in video sales in its infancy. And I remember we used to have right at the front of the store those big bins, you know, those dump bins full of just cheap VHS tapes, like, you know, $1.99 or whatever. And I remember there being umpteen different versions of this movie that were in there by you know, a dozen different distributors because it was public domain. And invariably, every copy that they were going off of was complete garbage. So, you know, if someone happened to pick it up and go, gee, you know, this looks like a Disney film, and buy it for, you know, Junior, they'd get it home and go, oh, this is crap, because the copy, you know, the print it was made from was just absolute garbage. But the company could put it out because it was public domain, so anybody could do it. Night of the Living Dead had the same thing for many, many years. Every copy you would find of Night of the Living Dead on VHS was complete crap because it was public domain. Anybody could release it. And so they would just get their hands on some ratty old print of it, slap it on VHS and make a quick buck. But there was no quality to it. Nobody had ever taken the time to, like, digitally remaster it or anything like that, so all the copies that were available were just garbage.
Well, same thing for It's a Wonderful Life,
until they took
it out of the public domain and remastered it.
Exactly, and so that probably really hurt the reputation of this because it was one of those ones that wound up, like, you know, the Fleischer Supermans are another great example. The Fleischer Supermans, for the longest time, yeah, you could buy VHS tapes that would have three or four episodes, often different episodes from each other, but the quality was absolute garbage until somebody, and I forget what company it was, there was one company that finally came along and acquired really good prints, cleaned them up to the best of their ability, and put all 17 on one VHS. And that was the first time that, you know, a whole new generation saw decent prints of those, and that's when they started to regain, you know, popularity and people talking about them again after decades of basically having been forgotten. And, you know, I probably sound like I've really been down on this movie, but my one big takeaway from this, you know, in the positive category, was that while in comparison with what Disney was doing, you know, to me, it's way, way behind. But if you take it isolated to just the studio, I could definitely see a lot of precursor stuff, a lot of stepping stone stuff to the Fleischer Supermans, which, you know, to me, as you know, just kind of a novice animation guy, you know, those Fleischer Superman still stand as some of the best hand-drawn animation that has ever existed. So while this doesn't hold up to Snow White, what comes from it, the lessons they learn here to do the later cartoons, you know, that would come along, I mean, that stuff actually did in a lot of ways outshine what Disney was doing, you know, in the world, especially with, you know, the use of rotoscoping for Superman and the different characters in that and everything. You know, they were really the pioneers of that stuff. So, you know, yeah.
You know, I do come back to the same thought, though, and I don't think any of us have I don't think we're disagreeing at any level, but I do think it's a matter of almost hindsight with the longevity of the Disney studio versus the quick demise of the Fleischer studios. And that's a big factor in this, because eventually Disney had so many other features to kind of keep themselves in the public consciousness, whereas Fleischer just didn't have that. I also think Fleischer is a victim a little bit of its own effort to be a little bit more grown up. And that's not so much in this particular feature, but in the stuff that they did before this, before the Hays Code, when they would have Betty Boop cartoons and things like that, that were eventually considered to be a little too racy for, to be continued. So, you know, and back then they were too racy, and then I think now they feel like it's too, sexualizing for women, that it's, you know, it's just not appropriate anymore. So they don't have the history to fall back on either. You know, they don't have the longevity afterwards, and they don't have the history beforehand. What they have is they have Popeye and they have Superman, and that's really what they have to kind of keep you going. And Popeye is the one that had the legs, really, because Superman, as right. great as they are, you know, they I never saw them until they started putting them out on DVDs.
Betty Boop had the legs.
I do think that's what it came down to. The other aspect of this that I find interesting with hindsight is, again, if I was just, you know, if this was all new release stuff and none of this had come before and none, you know, we don't know what's to come in the future, and we had Snow White and then we have this, and if you told me it was the same studio, I probably would have said, yeah, okay, I could buy that. You know, there are definite similarities between the Lilliputians and the dwarves as far as the character models and things, so there's a lot that I could go with on that. However, with the benefit of hindsight, with knowing other stuff from the Fleischer Studios, particularly Popeye cartoons, I definitely see the through line with the character models and things, and the voice actors. I mean, like I said, King Little is Popeye, is the same voice actor as Popeye. So, you know, we definitely have some stuff there to connect it all. And I find that all fascinating to look at in hindsight. And I think that's a big reason why we're doing this retrospective now.
Definitely.
So all that said, I think we can probably give a rating on this now. And I'll tell you, I was thinking long and hard about this. And I my range was wide, because I was thinking, you know, this captivated me as a child, and I loved this. And looking back on it today, I really enjoyed it. So I could rate it, you know, that it's a classic and that it's yours. On the other hand, it is a little bit dated, and there's points in it where the voice acting isn't quite what I wanted, and the characters are a little two-dimensional. So I could give it a Jaws 3. and it could be anywhere in there for me, but the more I kept going back on it, I was saying, you know what, I'm an old man now, and I still enjoy this animation, and I still enjoy this cartoon, and so it's got the ability to be rewatched, and I think there's points in it where it's just, for lack of a better word, that there's points where it's delightful. So I'm going to say it's a solid Jaws 2 for me. It's right in between those two.
I bought it. It was interesting when I was watching this through the first time. I was trying to think through, like, you know, where am I really at on this film? I will say it's a Jaws 2 for me, but let me explain the why. It's some of it's due to the fact that it's an important piece of history as you're watching it. The things that they were doing, the stage that it was setting. I enjoyed this, by the way. This isn't one of those things where I'm like, okay, this is something you're going to trudge through because of the fact that, you know, it's a historical piece. There's things like that I like. There's documentaries and things that I enjoy watching where it's a little bit of a chore to get through, but like the knowledge and the information you gather from it's great. This is not that. This was completely enjoyable. There's some sequences, like I'm with Scott, you know, some sequences that kind of go a little bit long, but never enough to ruin the experience of being with these people for me. I like the people. I find them charming. I like Gulliver. I think the movie benefits from the fact that he's asleep during certain parts, and when he actually gets up, the rotoscope kind of takes over for him. He's not meant to be this like overly like charming person or anything like that. I didn't dislike him either, though. He's a likable enough guy, you know, who just kind of, you know, ha ha ha. You know, like sometimes he's the brawny guy with the paper towels.
Jolly Green Giant, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Coming in. But I liked the film. I like this film enough that, and by the way, just for anybody out there that's curious about it, it's called Fleischer Classics, featuring Gulliver's Travels, plus 8 fantastic cartoons from the Golden Age of Animation, Blu-ray, DVD. It's a combo set over there. The reason why I'm referencing that is what Paul said earlier is incredibly accurate. What Scott said earlier is incredibly accurate. This thing is available in so many fashions that are going to give you not a good quality. This actually says in the description that it's the remastered version. I looked on Wikipedia. This is that remastered version that's out there. So be very careful if you're going to purchase this for the purpose of seeing it remastered, to seek out the one that's remastered. I want to see this remastered, and that's probably not because of the fact that it's just because it's an important part of animation history. I enjoyed it. I'll watch this again. Not because I'm forced to, because we're not going to do this again. So, for me, I want to own this because I'm watching this. I'd like to see, and if I watch it again, I'd like to see a really good quality of it.
For its place in, it does hold an important place in animation history and everything, for that, for the overall animation style, especially, backgrounds and the rotoscoping. I mean, a lot of it's very pretty and very well animated and everything. To me, it ultimately comes down to story and the characters. And I feel like that's where it shows its deficiencies in comparison with Disney, especially in comparison with Snow White. I don't feel like the characters are quite as well developed. I definitely didn't feel like the story was quite as well developed. And that could also be a symptom of, again, the rush to get it produced. Because basically they produced this movie in about half the time that it took Walt to produce Snow White. And that's including not just the animation, but story development and all the things, all the research, everything that went into making that film. So it's almost, in that aspect, almost an unfair comparison in a lot of ways, because this was rushed to the screen. I think that shows in a lot of ways, unfortunately, with this. I think with some tightening up, with some re-editing, with a little bit more script and character development, this could have been a timeless classic. Unfortunately, it kind of falls short in that aspect for me. I enjoy it, but I wasn't like captivated by it, and it there's portions where it was a bit of a slog to get through for me. So for me, it's a solid Jaws 3. I enjoy it. I respect its place in history. I don't expect I'll be sitting down to watch it again in full anytime soon. So that's a lot of it, is rewatchability. It's one of those things, if I've got to kind of suffer through it, then I can't give it a Jaws 2. So yeah, Jaws 3 for me. But that said, I did enjoy it, but more for the technical than the actual story and character, that sort of, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. Makes sense is that you're a hater. What can I tell you?
I did have a thought, though, a couple of things I wanted to point out here. For one, I love that apparently there was no great, like, war or animosity between these guys. Yes, they were adversaries at the box office, but I think it's very telling of Walt's character and everything that he actually handpicked Max Fleischer's son to direct 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, one of their biggest projects, and to this day still considered it, a Disney classic film. I think that's really neat, that he purposely chose him, his main competition's son. I think that's really cool. I would love to know, I wonder if there's notes that exist anywhere, anything. I would love to know, what did Walt think of this movie? I'm sure he saw it.
This was his competition. Yeah,
exactly. So I would love to know, if that information is still in existence somewhere, I'd love to know what his reactions were, because I'd just like to know, did he... You know, did he just say something simple like, eh, you know, not as good? Or did he go into detail like, I would have done this, I would have done that? Did he outright enjoy it and think, hey, that was pretty good? I would just love to know what his reactions were to it.
I don't know if he ever shared those thoughts, but I guarantee you he had them. Guarantee you, if you're in the business that he was in, especially at the level he was, you have to see something like this come out, and not only do you want to see it because you're scoping out the competition, but you're also going to be looking at it to say, hey, they did this, that's a pretty good innovation, and I could take that even a step further. You know, whatever things that they did that he didn't do, and I couldn't even tell you exactly, oh, this fucking dog. Whatever things they did that he didn't, I'm sure he looked at it and said, how can I do that even better?
Right.
How could you not? Right.
Wait, there's an interesting twist to this. Are you guys familiar with Gulliver Mickey from 1934?
Yeah.
Pinto Colvig, you know, who played Gabby?
Right.
Was Pluto in Gulliver Mickey. He actually was in both.
They're tied awesome. Together at levels you can't even imagine.
That's awesome. Actually, I had forgotten that there was a Gulliver Mickey. That might be the scene I'm thinking of with him waking up on the beach, like tethered to the beach as opposed to, you know, drug into town kind of thing. I have that image in my head. It's not real clear. You know what I mean?
Mm. That's most of the images in my head.
You know, there are, at this point, there's got to be thousands of books and articles and movies and everything else all about the life of Walt Disney. If somebody wants to produce something new that I would definitely shell out good money for, I would love to read a book of Walt's reactions to non-Disney movies that he watched during his lifetime. Because I'm fascinated with the thought, he discovered... what's the actor's name? The actor that played Davy Crockett.
Fess Parker.
Fess Parker. He discovered Fess Parker for that role by seeing Fess Parker in Them. That's still something I can't quite wrap my mind around, is Walt Disney watching the movie Them. Is that not a trip to think about? I would love to know, what did Walt think of Them? You know? Yeah. It's just two worlds that you don't think of as colliding, but they did, and I think that's really neat. I would love a book of those kind of stories. You know, Walt watching movies that you just don't associate with him at all. But he did. He was voracious about watching everything else that, you know, his competition, essentially, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's neat.
I agree. So next thing we're going to look at in this particular retrospective will be Pinocchio.
Pinocchio.
And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, where we went from here. I'm really, like, looking forward to it. I don't know exactly, you know, this is not a every other week thing. You know, we get some time in between them, but we're going to get there, and we're going to keep going because there's just so much quality to be mined in this Disney vault.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm looking forward to a lot of them. Anyway, thanks for coming on with us, Scott. And
thank you for having me.
Tell everybody where they could find you.
These days, primarily at Back to the Bins, which is also on the Two True Freaks Network.
That sounds like a fascinating show.
It's all right.
And thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
My name is Gulliver, Your Majesty. Lemuel Gulliver, a shipwrecked sailor. At your service.
Well, welcome to Lilliput, Mr. Gulliver. Mr. Gulliver, can you fight?
Well, Your Majesty, I can lick anybody my size.
Ah, splendid, splendid. I don't think Bombo will give us any further trouble while you're around here. No, sir. He's on our side, Gabby. He's on our side. There's nothing to fear. The Mad Mountain's on our side. sing for you and me for
us and me
forever. Come on, where are those buttons?
It's a happy day. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do